how Americans view gas prices, inflation, and other kitchen table issues can sink a president's reelection. So what does that mean for President Joe Biden? Or Ohio's own Sherrod Brown? We're unpacking whether it's still the economy, stupid, and we begin with the fight to raise Ohio's minimum wage. Joining me now to talk the economy, the election, and the fight for $15 an hour is U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders. The Vermont senator is here in Ohio ahead of a rally in Parma Thursday evening. Senator Sanders, welcome to All Sides.
Great to be with you.
Let's start with the reason for your visit, the minimum wage. Ohio's hourly wage is $10.45 per hour, which, if you do the math, is just shy of $22,000 a year, an amount that I think most people would find hard to live on in central Ohio. So, basic question, why should Ohio voters raise that minimum salary to $31,000 a year?
Well, as you've indicated, I mean, it's almost unimaginable to think about people trying to get by on $22,000 a year, pay rent, pay for food, pay for childcare, transportation, a car, all that stuff. It's hard to believe that anybody can in fact live on that kind of low income. What I would say is the great economic crisis facing our country right now is that we have more income and wealth inequality than we've ever had in the history of the United States. And I know it's not talked about very much in the corporate media, it's not talked about very much in the halls of Congress, but the truth is the people on top today, the 1%, have never, ever had it so good. Their incomes are soaring, their wealth is soaring, corporate profits are in many cases soaring. Meanwhile, 60% of Americans are living paycheck to paycheck, and we've got over 500,000 people sleeping out on the street. So what has been going on in a number of states around the country is people have been putting ballot items on saying, hey, in our state, the minimum wage has got to go up. And that's what's going on in Ohio right now. And as you've indicated, this is not a radical idea. I mean, it means in a two-year period to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour by January 1st, 2026. So I would hope that Ohio would join many other states in voting to raise that minimum wage. And I should also say that the federal government certainly has been derelict in its responsibility. Nationally, minimum wage is an unbelievably low, $7.25 an hour. I am trying hard to raise that minimum wage to $17 an hour. At this point, I think we have zero Republican support for that, but we're going to keep trying to raise that minimum wage to a living wage.
Yeah, I did want to ask about that. How did you land on $17 an hour for a national minimum wage?
You can go higher than that. I mean, it's kind of common sense that if you, there are studies out there, MIT, for example, does studies. How much does it cost to live, whether you're in Cleveland or in Akron or wherever you may be, or in Burlington, Vermont? How much do you have to spend for rent? How much do you spend for food? How much do you spend for transportation? And it comes out that the living wage, the amount of money to live in security and dignity is much higher, much, much higher than, say, $15 an hour or even $17 an hour. But, the political reality is at this particular point in Congress, given zero Republican support or virtually no Republican support and some hesitant Democrats, $17 an hour would be the best, I think, that we can get at this point.
Yeah, I did the math here. So the median rent in Columbus, where we're based, is $1,500 a month. So if you earn that minimum wage, that $22,000 a year, your median rent, your rent would take up 82% of your gross salary. Even a cheap apartment. Right. So you can kind of sometimes find them under $1,000 a month, like a studio. That would put you at the 50%. You'd be spending 50% of your gross, not your take home, on rent.
Right. And to get to that, so you have rent, which is a big factor. Most people have to eat, and food costs you money. If you have a kid, childcare costs you money. To get to work, you need a car, and transportation, the car or public transportation costs you money. So again, the reality here is tens and tens of millions of people in Ohio, in Vermont, all over this country are really struggling to make ends meet. And one way, and not the only way, but one way to improve life for those people is to say, hey, you're going to earn at least a decent minimum wage. And again, to my mind, a $15 an hour minimum wage is quite minimal. It should be higher, but it's a step forward.
What's your take on excluding tipped workers from this minimum wage raise? So the Ohio Restaurant Association says it's asked Ohio servers, and overwhelmingly they don't want this raise because they're worried they'll actually earn less, the idea being customers would tip less and that their overall take-home pay would go down.
I don't believe that for a second. I mean, I think you have a very aggressive organization, the Restaurant Association. They're working really hard. But, you know, if you look at, you know, the truth is, and my daughter used to be a waitress, there are some people who work as waiters and waitresses or in service industries who do very well. They make really a pretty good living. But there are other people, you know, if you're working in a rural diner and it's a rainy day or people are not coming in, you know, you may not even make the minimum wage. Are you really going to make it on nationally, the tip wage? Nationally, it's like, I think, $2.13 an hour, something like that. In Ohio, it is higher than that. It's, I think, 5.25.
Yeah.
But to my mind, we have got to raise both the general wage and the minimum wage. And the tip minimum wage would be phased out by 2029, which I think is a good step forward for people who work in restaurants.
Wages are really what we would call a kitchen table issue. It's a reflection of how voters feel about the economy and ultimately how they feel about the direction of our country. How important do you think these kinds of economic issues are going to be in this election? So basically what I'm asking is it still the economy, stupid?
I think by and large it is. It's not, and I would argue, the most important issue. Is abortion, the right of women to be able to control their own bodies, very important? Yes. Is the future of American democracy, or we have people undermining the foundations of American democracy, important? You know, people are sitting home and they're saying, you know, I can't afford, I'm having a hard time putting gas in the car, I'm having a hard time, you know, paying for my credit card debt, sending my kid to college, paying my mortgage, paying rent. These are huge issues. And I would say that in terms of the economy, we have made some progress. Right now in my state, for example, our problem is not unemployment. It is virtually at a record low. Our problem is we don't have enough workers to rebuild our crumbling infrastructure. We don't have enough workers in healthcare. We don't have enough teachers. We have major workforce shortages in many parts of our economy. To do, in my view, is not only raise the minimum wage nationally to a living wage, we've got to do what every other major country on earth does. You want to talk about an economic issue? It's healthcare. We have a broken, dysfunctional healthcare system. We're the only major country on earth not to guarantee healthcare at all, despite spending twice as much per capita. You want to control inflation. You want to improve life for the American people. Do what virtually every other major country does. Make healthcare a human right. Pass something like a Medicare for All single-payer program.
You know, jobs in the economy, issues like healthcare, kitchen table issues are kind of a particularly touchy subject to those in Ohio, especially those in what we call the Rust Belt. We just had a special election here, the 6th Congressional District. It's not too far from where you're holding your rally in Parma. And the Democrat running did better than expected. He still lost by 10 points, but Bill Johnson used to win that district by 30 points. And it's a special election, so you can sometimes write those off. But one of the things that the Democrat running said is that he doesn't see the district as solidly Trump country, but it is a place, quote, abandoned by the Democratic Party. And I wonder if you agree with that sentiment, that people from places like the Mahoning Valley turned to Donald Trump because they didn't feel like they were being heard or helped anymore by Democrats.
I think there was a lot of truth to that. And I say that sadly. I am an independent, the longest serving independent in the history of our country. But I caucus with the Democrats, and I see the Democrats as, on economic issues, much more preferable than the Republicans. But here's the truth, and it's true in my state as well. If you're an ordinary working person, you're struggling with the cost of health care. You're seeing inflation surpassing your wages. You're struggling with low wages. You're worried about how you're going to be able to retire. Half of our people have nothing in the bank for retirement. Then you're hearing Republicans talking about wanting to cut Social Security, cut Medicare, and the Affordable Care Act. So I think there is a lot of economic stress on working families. They look to Washington and they say, you know what, Nobody hears my pain. Nobody knows what it's like to live, on $30,000-$40,000 a year. And I think that is one of the reasons why Trump has been as successful as he is. And the alternative to success, sometimes not with success, is to understand that they've got to have the courage to take on very, very powerful special interests who, to a large degree today, control both our economic and political life. Now, what does it mean? It means, and we're working hard on this right now, we should not be paying by far the highest prices in the world for prescription drugs because of the greed of the pharmaceutical industry. Should not be spending twice as much per capita on healthcare as any other country because of the greed of the insurance companies. We should be having a minimum wage in this country, which is a livable wage, despite what the Walmarts of the world and the Restaurant Association would like. We should be making public colleges and universities tuition free so our kids can get the best higher education that they need to help us grow our economy without leaving school $50,000 or $100,000 in debt. We need a major housing program in this country to address the housing crisis, which exists in virtually every state in the union. So there's, what you need right now is a government which works for working people, not just the 1%. But I should tell you, because of a disastrous campaign finance system, right now, as we speak, you're having these PACs, incredible PACs, political action committees, which can now spend as much as they want, super PACs, controlled by billionaires. So if you're running for office trying to defend the working class, you can run into opposition from a super PAC, which is spending millions of dollars against you. So we have to address a corrupt political system in order to improve the economy for working people.
I want to drill down on something you just said there, because we spent 6 episodes earlier this year in a series we're calling Untangled, going into the housing crisis here in Central Ohio. And, one of the things that we found that a minimum wage worker here in Central Ohio would need to work 271 hours per week. That's 6 full-time jobs, more of the hours than exist in a week. But that's how much they would have to work to qualify for the median home price here in Central Ohio. And it's one of those issues when you look at the cost of childcare, college, housing. Sometimes it's interesting to me because everything still feels so expensive, even though we're being told on a macro level that the economy is doing well. Unemployment is down, inflation is leveling off, wages are rising, but it doesn't feel that way, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does make sense. And wages are rising, but in many respects, for the needs of people, they're not keeping up with what people are purchasing. So I understand that people are feeling hard pressed economically. And housing, I can tell you, if you come to Burlington, Vermont, very, very, very hard to find affordable housing. So it's an issue, I will tell you. We attempted early on in the Biden administration to pass a major piece of legislation called Build Back Better, which would have addressed, in many respects, the childcare crisis, would have made real steps forward in terms of healthcare, and would have put a huge amount of money into starting to build the low-income and affordable housing this country desperately needs. We need housing for senior citizens. We need assisted living housing. We need low-income housing. Sometimes we forget we're the richest country in the history of the world, and what a disgrace it is to have some 600,000 people sleeping out on the streets because they don't have affordable housing. So this is a major issue, and we can put workers to work at good wages building that housing. So this has got to be very high up on, I hope, President Biden's agenda if he wins re-election.
And speaking of that re-election, we hear a lot of conversation about the future of our democracy in terms of who's going to win in November. What do you think is at stake for our economy in this election?
Well, I think it's pretty clear. Working class people are hurting. As I mentioned earlier, in the richest country in the history of the world, 60% of our people live paycheck to paycheck, while at the other end, you got three richest people in America owning more wealth than the bottom half of American society. So you have an economy that is doing phenomenally well for the very rich, not doing well for the working class and the middle class of this country. So what do we do? I mean, I think we start addressing the issues facing working people. We talked about housing being one of them. Are we capable of building the kinds of low-income and affordable housing that we desperately need? Of course we are. But it means maybe instead of putting $900 billion into the military, maybe instead of giving $1 trillion in tax breaks to the very richest people in the country, which is what Trump did, maybe we invest in low-income and affordable housing so that every American can find a dwelling that they can afford. That's one issue. Again, I talked about healthcare. We are the only major country on earth not to guarantee healthcare to all human beings as a right. And we've got to move in that direction. So healthcare is a major issue. The cost of higher education is off the charts. We can't compete globally with other countries unless we have a well-educated workforce. That means making, in my view, public colleges and universities tuition free. We have a tax system, which is grossly unfair. If you are a billionaire today, your effective tax rate is lower than that as a nurse or a truck driver. And you have some large corporations making billions, paying not a nickel in taxes. So there's an enormous amount of work to be done. Problem we're having is Congress is dominated by big money interest and their campaign contributions and their super PACs, who elect people who are there not to represent working families, but the very, very rich. So we've got to reform our political system so that we can have a Congress that starts dealing with the needs of the working class of this country, not just the 1%.
The final question is actually about Congress. Senator Sherrod Brown has an election coming up, and it is between him and a self-made, billionaire here in the state of Ohio, Bernie Moreno. Are you supportive of sending Senator Brown back to Congress?
Absolutely. I have known Sherrod for many, many years. We served in the House together. We came into the Senate together. And the people of Ohio should be very proud. Sherrod is certainly one of the strongest fighters for the needs of the working class in the United States Congress. So I hope very much that he is reelected. We need him desperately.
That was U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders. Thank you so much for your time this morning.
Thank you very much.
Sanders's rally with One Fair Wage starts at 7 p.m. at UAW Local 1005 in Parma. The rally is free to attend, but people are encouraged to RSVP online. Coming up, an economist explains why the macro economy can be doing well, while our own personal budgets are not. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wildcard wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staber. America's economy is growing. Unemployment is low. Inflation is finally coming down. Salaries are rising. Job creation is exceeding expectations. These all sound like signs of a steady economy, the kind of numbers any president would want to stake their reelection campaign on. And yet, most Americans are displeased with how things are going. 41% told Pew Research Center that the economy is fair, and another 30% rated it as poor. Matthew Rosu is the dean and professor of economics at Susquehanna University, and he joins me now to explain the disconnect between how we feel and the economic indicators. Welcome to All Sides, Matthew.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
I want to start with inflation, because CNBC surveyed American adults this spring, and two-thirds of us said inflation is the main driver of our financial stress. But when you Google inflation, all the news is that it's down, back where it should be. So why do we still perceive it as so very high?
It's a great question. And I think there are a few different reasons for this. First, inflation is down from the peaks of a couple years ago, but it is still over 3%. And in the decade before this spike, it never crossed 3%. And most of the time it was at 2%. So it is still a little bit higher than everybody is used to. A second reason, when prices are going up 3%, but prices had just gone up 10%, that 3% increase is now on a higher base price. So 3% of, say, $100 would be less than 3% of $112. So that price increase could seem a little magnified. A third factor for why I think Americans could think inflation really isn't doing that well is our inflation rate. And there are good reasons for this, but the inflation rate doesn't capture changes in borrowing money or the interest rates. And interest rates are quite a bit higher. So if you go to get a car loan, for example, you could easily be paying an extra $100 a month in interest. And that very much is a cost of living factor for you, but that's not captured in the official statistics. So I think there are several reasons why Americans could be thinking, well, inflation really doesn't seem that great, even though the official number is getting a lot better.
Yeah, also prices haven't come down, right? You think inflation Correct. Is down. For some reason, our brain says, then why are eggs still so expensive? But the only way prices come down would be a drop in consumer spending. And that's not happening either.
Yeah, so inflation is an increase in prices. For prices to come down, we would actually need deflation, which we've had a couple times in the past 20 years by 8% or so. In various products, you see it from time to time when there's technological improvements, especially, right? The televisions you get now are way better and way cheaper than what you could have, what you could have bought at the store 5, 10, 20, 50 years ago. Overall, though, the prices, it is doubtful that prices will drop back down. What we hope for is a more stable increase in the price rate.
Right. And because they went up so fast, so quickly, I remember what eggs cost 2-3 years ago. And so even if they're not rising by 20-30% anymore, I'm still like, you know, they're way more expensive than I remember.
Yes. And for products like that, where you're purchasing them often, it will jump out. One of my bigger vices is probably a Diet Coke addiction.
And I share that. It's okay.
That has gone up way more than the average prices, the average price increases, and it hasn't dropped back down. And yeah, I'm reminded every time I go to the grocery store that, wow, this is like literally double what I was paying 3 years ago.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that former President Donald Trump points to as a success of his is that gas prices were so very low when he was in office. And I think this is a great example of what we're talking about, because gas prices did hit like below $2, sometimes even close to $1 a gallon in early 2020. But I think that's more of an example, and I want to get your take on it, of a steep drop in consumer spending because we were all at home and we weren't driving anywhere.
Yeah. So overall, if you're going to rate the Trump on the gas prices, I think there's some truth to it. Overall, even pre-COVID, if you look at the gas prices under Trump and the gas prices under Biden, they were a little lower under Trump. But the much lower prices that you saw in 2020 were really a factor of consumers not driving as much as we would teach in. This is actually a very good economics 101 example. There would have been a fall in the demand. A drop in the demand curve, which caused the lower prices in 2020 to be incredibly low in that particular year.
So it sounds like he can say, yes, gas prices were cheaper, but when he points to like $1 a gallon, that's a bit of a stretch.
Yes. Yeah. I saw a chart and I don't have it off the top of my head that showed year by year. And they were on average a little bit cheaper, maybe 30, 40 cents cheaper per gallon, which is still money. But it did not average under $2 per gallon during his presidency.
I also want to unpack why inflation rose so fast during the pandemic, because people are pointing a lot of fingers at who's to blame. And I have some possible reasons why that I'd like to run through one by one. So the first is the conservative government spending. that the federal government spent a ton of money during COVID, three different relief packages totaling trillions of dollars, and that increased demand and therefore inflation.
I think the spending might have had something to do with it. I don't know that that was the major factor in it. I think there's a related factor that goes along with the government spending. Most economists, almost, I think economists universally, when COVID first hit, would have been very supportive of that first bill. I mean, basically, this is, quite frankly, it was crisis time in March and April of 2020. Things had to be done. Far fewer economists would have been supportive of the second one, and that was passed under the Trump administration. And we think it would have been a minority of economists for the third one that was passed. For some of the reasons might have been inflation, but some might have been other reasons as well.
Yeah. And one of the things to keep in mind is not investing those dollars, right? If we had never done any of it, we could have had a recession. And we can't really go back and do the experiment all over again to see if the recession would have been preferable to the inflation.
Yeah, well, we did have a recession in 2020, even with the spending. But the spending, the spending likely helped keep it, even though it was very severe and very sharp. We came out of it. So the bill that was passed, I believe it was March of 2021, the unemployment rate was already back down pretty low. That's why more economists, I don't know if there was polls on this necessarily. I was more skeptical of that last one and did not think that should have happened because the economy was doing better, right? If you're going to pass a spending bill because you want the things in a spending bill, that's one thing. If you're passing it to try to fix the economy, well, the economy was on the track to being fixed at that point in time.
So another reason people have given why inflation rose was supply chain deficiencies, right? Like we all remember the clogged docks of goods waiting to get in the country during COVID. There were shortages of workers due to illness. So, you know, supply chain deficiencies raise prices.
Yes. Yes, I think that's pretty fair. I don't know that there's much more to add to that.
Yeah.
If it costs more to ship a product, you would expect to see higher prices for the end product.
Yeah, one of the progressive explainers for some of the inflation is one that U.S. Senator Sherrod Brown has been talking about a lot here in Ohio, and that's corporate greed. The idea of shrinkflation and record products that companies saw a moment and they went ahead and raised their prices and shrunk their products.
That has gotten a lot of press recently, and I think that explanation does not hold much credence. In order for that explanation to be true, one of two things would have had to have happened. One is you assumed, okay, corporations weren't greedy when inflation was low. I believe that they were probably greedy then and they are greedy now. And I really would find it tough to believe that their degree of greed has really changed much.
Mm.
Or you could say something has changed so dramatically that it's caused them to raise prices dramatically. I don't know what that is, and I have not heard a good explanation for what that factor is. A third point, if you want to buy into the greedflation argument, which I don't think anybody should, but if you want to, when gas prices drop, I would expect you to be out there talking about how generous the gas companies are. Because, hey, you know, they could have, you know, they just decided to charge less. None of us are going to do that because, well, it would be ridiculous. They're not charging less because they want to. They're charging because it's market forces, but that's also what leads to the price increases as well.
That actually leads me into my final explanation or theory about why inflation rose, and that is the war in Ukraine causing energy and other supply shortages.
Well, if supply drops, that would increase prices. I would suspect that that's not a major factor. The factor that I think probably is biggest is related to the government spending. But a lot of economists, there was a famous phrase that inflation is always and everywhere a monetary phenomenon. That was it was a long time ago, and Milton Friedman was the original kind of coined the phrase. It may not be always and everywhere a monetary phenomenon, but the money supply and the link to inflation, it is incredibly highly correlated. So the issue with the initial spending bill is, did the Federal Reserve essentially have to print more money to fund it? And if that's the case, that's why I mentioned in the first explanation, or one of the what's on the government spending. I don't know if it was the first or the
second.
It was
the first.
that I don't know that the bill itself was what caused it, but if the government had to print more money and the money supply has gone up in order to fund it, that I think is a pretty legitimate cause of inflation and a good reason.
I want to shift and talk about interest rates, which we touched on earlier, because interest rates, I think, sometimes get conflated with inflation. But in terms of real dollars, you know, it's exacerbated the housing shortage. It's made cars more expensive. It's made any kind of purchasing on credit more expensive.
Correct. Yeah, it's the numbers on this. And I ran through the numbers just recently as an example for myself. If somebody was getting a $30,000 car loan at 8% interest rate, you're paying initially $2,400 in interest a year. If you got it at 4%, which doesn't sound that unreasonable of a rate 3 or 4 years ago, it would have only been $1,200. And that's $100 a month.
Yeah. And you're definitely going to be feeling that now. And you know what I find fascinating is interest rates feel really, really high right now. But historically, like, they're kind of in line. Like, post-2008, 2009 recession, they got low and then they stayed low for about a decade.
Yes, we haven't had the – where they are now, maybe traditionally over the past 50 years, is not I wanted to say insanely high. But, you know, it's not really that far out of line. But, you know, it's when you had, what was it, 13 years or 12 years from 2008 through 2021, when interest rates were incredibly low for houses, for cars, for everything. That's a long time. That's a long time for people to kind of get used to this as a new normal.
Yeah. You know, I want to ask, do you think the pandemic changed how Americans think about our economy? Because, like, I want to give an example. So, like, personal savings rates soared in 21 and 22, in part because of that government spending, right? They were giving us just, like, a bunch of money to get through. But Americans didn't feel positive about it. You know, car buying. People bought a lot of cars during the pandemic. And that was supposed to mean if you buy a lot of cars, you feel good about the economy. There's all these, like, traditional markers. And it doesn't seem like they work anymore.
It's a great question in terms of, like, the long term, like, the psychological view. And I'm not really certain of the answer. I mean, COVID has changed so much in so many ways. And it was really a traumatic experience in many ways. There's little things that come up that I still think that bring me back to some of the things, the opportunities that were lost with COVID, that it makes sense that it would cause a shift. But I couldn't tell you, like, what was the shift and how are people thinking differently because of COVID?
Yeah, we may need a couple more years to kind of parse out how it changed public opinion on the economy.
Yes.
But I want to end with the question of giving a president credit, right? Because there is that famous line, it's the economy. Actually, I think it's the economy, stupid. But now we say it's the economy, stupid. Yeah. And, you know, presidents love to take credit for a good economy and blame a bad economy on everything but themselves. But how much credit should they actually get? Like, how much does the U.S. president change the economic outlook of our country?
That is a great question. Presidents generally get too much credit and receive too much blame. There are things that can be done on the margins, and that can definitely have an influence. If we're looking at gas prices, for example, there have been restrictions on energy in the past few years that should lead to an increase in gas prices. That's kind of a natural one. Tax policy and regulations can have an impact on the economy. But overall, right, you're dealing with 330 million people, and the economy doesn't react instantly to any one particular action. And the president's one person in a government that's, you know, has also the legislative branch, the supreme, you know, and the judicial branch.
Force the Fed to lower the interest rate.
Yep. The Fed has independence in that regard. So I think on average, presidents, they do have some influence. They could take a little credit and a little blame. But overall, presidents receive, we give them way too much credit or way too much blame. Or unfortunately, what often happens is, you know, if you're on a particular party, you will give the person in your party all the credit and say, well, they didn't deserve the blame, or vice versa. And I think both members of both parties are unfortunately guilty of that.
Yeah, but "I was kind of responsible for making things moderately better" isn't really a good slogan.
That's not the, I had a marginally positive impact. That's not the campaign slogan that most people would have. I'd love to hear it, actually. That's I'm guessing I'll be waiting a while.
That was Matthew Rosu, Dean and Professor of Economics at Susquehanna University. Thank you so much for your time this morning.
Yeah, thank you again for having me on.
Coming up, whether the economy stupid will apply to the U.S. Senate race between Democrat Sherrod Brown and Republican Bernie Moreno. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wildcard wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. We're talking this hour about that famous phrase from Bill Clinton's 1992 campaign. It's the economy, stupid. Although it was actually the economy, stupid, but we're not going to parse how exactly it was written on the whiteboard in his campaign office. But we are talking about how kitchen table issues like wages, jobs, and the cost of groceries will be the biggest issue in our upcoming election. So far, we've heard from U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders, who is in Ohio for a rally to raise our minimum wage, an economist about how much credit presidents really deserve for economic health. Now, we're going to drill down on the politics at play here in Ohio. Joining me is Professor David Niven, a political science professor at the University of Cincinnati, and he's a former advisor to Ohio Governor Ted Strickland. Welcome back to All Sides, David.
It's my pleasure, Anna.
So this election cycle actually reminds me a bit of 1992, at least when it comes to the economy. So George Bush Sr. was president, and the economy was growing, but it was growing slowly, and voters didn't feel like things were going great. President Bush tried leaning on the objective numbers, right? He pointed to all the positive indicators. He even tried telling Americans not to exaggerate the problems in our economy. That didn't work. None of it actually worked, and Bill Clinton beat him that November. So are we looking at a similar situation now with a president sitting on a decent economy, but he can't quite communicate that to voters?
Well, there's certainly a parallel, as you just suggested, in terms of a president kind of having to tread water with an economy that has some positives, but where people feel unsettled about it. But there's one huge difference between 92 and today, which is that the first George Bush was uniquely ill-suited to identify with regular people and their economic struggles. And that's not something that President Biden suffers from. There was a famous moment in that 92 campaign. It was the first time they'd put regular people in a debate and had them ask the questions.
Oh, I know what you're talking about.
And the lady gets up. Yeah, and she gets up and she asks the president about sort of the pain of the economic situation. And he goes off on a tangent totally disconnected from the woman. He gives a clinical answer. And then it was Bill Clinton's turn. And he famously walked toward the woman and totally locked on her. She was the only person in the world. And he asked her, instead of him answering the question, he asked her to talk a little bit about her life. And then he talked about what his agenda was. And that really set, you know, George Bush up for seeming totally disconnected. And so, you know, there's definitely an overlap in the atmosphere of this is an unsettled economy, but there isn't quite the same matchup of, you know, of candidate personalities.
The other thing that's pretty different is it seems like the economic fundamentals that presidents, pollsters, and politicos like yourself have relied upon for decades to predict or add to those calculations on who's going to win the election, those fundamentals don't seem to really apply so much anymore. And, you know, because when Trump presided over a decent economy in 2020 and he still lost. You know, here's American businessman Tom Steyer at the Democratic debate before that election. Oh, it looks like we don't have that cut. I apologize. So Steyer basically says it's the economy, stupid. Trump's running on the economy. He's going hard about it. And we're going to lose the election in 2020 if we don't beat him on the economy. But it didn't really seem like that's what it came down to in 2020.
Well, I think we have to understand that the lessons that we've taken about economics and politics are wildly out of date. And even the example you gave of 1992, we were still in a phase then where if you made your money by working with your hands, you were overwhelmingly likely to vote Democratic. And if you made your money by putting your money to work for you, you were overwhelmingly likely to vote Republican. And that those things are just not the case anymore. That's not the divide. And it's a fantastic understanding of what happened in Ohio. Why was Ohio the most competitive political state for a century, and now it's a solidly Republican state at the presidential level? It's because that economic divide no longer predicts things. Democrats can't count on the votes of, you know, Northeastern Ohioans anymore. Republicans, you know, literally haven't lost Delaware County since Woodrow Wilson was in office. And yet Democrats are creeping upward there again, because it's no longer that absolutely sort of simple economic divide. And so you're going to get rich and poor voting the same way, in a way that you wouldn't have, you know, a generation ago.
That's a perfect pivot to the election coming up here in Ohio between Democrat Sherrod Brown and Republican Bernie Moreno. I wonder how much time you think Senator Brown is going to spend on the economy and other pocketbook issues, particularly when it comes to winning those blue collar voters in the Mahoning Valley.
Well, I think Senator Brown is going to spend a lot of time there for a couple reasons. One, it's who he is. And one of his great advantages in this race is Sherrod Brown is uniquely Sherrod Brown. He is always in character. He is always on message. That this is his defining purpose in office. So it's not just, you know, what he wants to talk about. It's what he has to talk about. It's what he is. So that's one. Two is, fundamentally, campaigns are about contrast. You, as a candidate, you want to suggest the thing to voters that they should decide this race about. And the thing you suggest is the thing that, you know, reflects well on you and reflects poorly on your opponent. And I think this is why Democrats boosted Bernie Moreno in the first place during the primary, because they like the idea of Sherrod Brown and his dignity of work message going up against, you know, a car dealer turned politician. It's just the kind of contrast, you know, that they believe works very well for them and does help them recapture that Northeast Ohio base that Democrats can't win without.
Yeah, I think we're definitely going to hear a lot about the dignity of work. I think that's a phrase that Sherrod Brown is going to take out throughout this campaign. But I do want to ask, how do you think the minimum wage ballot question will play out in November? Not whether it'll win or lose, but how it might impact like the Senate race.
I mean, this is one of the most fascinating things about Ohio. If you line up the way Ohioans vote on ballot questions, you know, we saw this on reproductive rights. We've seen this in the past on the minimum wage.
And
if
marijuana.
If you line it up issue after issue, this would superficially seem like a pretty, you know, liberal state, certainly no more than a moderate state. And yet, if you look at how Ohioans vote, you know, for candidates, this looks like a pretty conservative state. It looks like a very, very red state. And so, you know, I think the bottom line is this is an issue that Democrats win on. You know, they don't win in Ohio largely on cultural questions. They don't win because the average Ohioan doesn't think Democrats are like them, doesn't think they understand them. But they do win on issues. They actually, you know, on really, really important things like reproductive rights and something as fundamental as the minimum wage, Democrats have a history of winning on this. So this is great for Sherrod Brown and, you know, just the keeping the top of mind what he's talking about. You know, it doesn't even have to change anybody's mind. It just has to remind them, hey, this is what's at stake. And I think this is why I've been surprised thus far in the Bernie Moreno campaign that you know, he's been engaging on sort of personal politics when I think the game for him is to get the conversation away from that.
You know, one of the sort of darker questions that has been knocking around in my brain since I started putting together this show on whether it's still the economy stupid is that I wonder if the traditional model, the economy stupid, is giving way to a party tribalism. And essentially what I'm asking is, are we so partisan now that the economic circumstances of our country matter less than which party we're voting for?
I'll give you two answers to that. First is yes, you know, that we're viewing everything through a party lens. And so, you know, Republicans in their minds are experiencing a worse economy. And, you know, one of the tricks to how we perceive the economy is it's typically not just a personal equation. It's typically our assessment of what others are going through, which gives us an awful lot of wiggle room to discount even good things that are happening to us. But let me put this into an even bigger context for you. There's a question that Gallup has been asking forever, and it's, you know, are you satisfied with, you know, the life in this country? And do you know the last time a majority of Americans said they were satisfied? You want to take a guess?
2006.
That's not bad. 2002.
Oh, I was close.
Yeah, it's a very good guess. Yeah, you know, Price is Right. You're definitely going to go out a winner here. But 2002, which means this is really, really important. We're viewing everything from a lens of dissatisfaction. So, you know, this is very different from saying there are good times and bad times. This is there are bad times and there are worse times, which creates, you know, for presidents and, you know, office holders, it creates this just sort of simmering, you know, sort of level of grievance, this simmering level of discomfort, which means, you know, it isn't as stark as, you know, being able to say, hey, economy's, you know, perking up. That's gonna help the president. Well, not necessarily when people feel like things are busted. And, you know, even and this is a key to Trump. You know, he didn't actually produce the results that he ran on. There's no wall. None of these things happened. But he disrupted the conversation in a, you know, in a context of grievance, and people liked that. His supporters liked that. So it's not about actual output as much as it's about that feeling.
So what you're telling me is this is going to be essentially a vibes election.
Absolutely. And you know, it's really, it's just negative versus even more negative are your choices.
Do you think we're in a good economy right now? I guess I'll just ask you the personal question.
I mean, bottom line, yes. I mean, we have an extraordinarily low unemployment rate, which is just the absolute building block of, you know, the American family life. So, you know, I think sort of the basics, and as you heard from, you know, your panel of economists and U.S. senators, you know, there's a basic relationship here. If more people are employed, prices are going to go up because more people are making money and spending that money. But, you know, I think the difficulty and you know, poll after poll shows this. There's so much personal feeling involved that it doesn't particularly matter. I mean, if you line up issue after issue, you know, not only doesn't the president get a lot of credit for the economy, but, you know, he doesn't get credit for infrastructure. Infrastructure, like this is a defining thing of the administration, you know, and you know, it's just gotten, you know, we've kind of slipped away from, you know, some basic realities.
I think that's an important point because, you know, if somebody says the economy is the most important issue to them, I think what the poll can't capture is you kind of need to peel that back and understand what they mean by that in order to understand or try to predict their voting behavior.
Right. And I think Senator Sanders was right to say how different things, you know, present themselves. You know, if you're a parent with a kid in high school worrying about paying for college, you know, what the economy means looks an awful lot different than if you're struggling to get, you know, full-time hours, you know, as a young worker versus, you know, if you were, you know, looking at retirement and trying to make that work. So, you know, I do think it masks an awful lot, and that, you know, inflation is a nice way of just, you know, keeping the discontent at a simmering level, but doesn't necessarily mean all that much in a practical level. If, you know, if the jobs are there, you know, people are making vastly more, you know, in an Amazon warehouse today than they would have been making, you know, 5 or 10 years ago. If the jobs are there, there is, you know, there's a bottom line, you know, that affects us all.
That was political science professor David Niven. Thank you so much for your time this morning.
Oh, my pleasure.
And thank you all for listening to Whether It's Still the Economy Stupid here on All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.